How can faith and reason work together? Are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play in the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we're discussing Dr. Craig's book, Reasonable Faith. Now, I want to remind you as we begin this conversation that there are many resources like this podcast available at reasonablefaith.org. In the new revised version of Reasonable Faith, your book, Dr. Craig, you expand the section on the existence of God arguments. About five of them. We've talked about two of them. Let's talk about some more. The design argument, the moral argument, and the ontological argument. What is your take on the design argument?
Well, the design argument has come roaring back into prominence in our day and age as a result of the discovery that the initial conditions of the universe present in the Big Bang itself had to be fine-tuned to an incomprehensible delicacy and complexity in order for intelligent life to evolve and exist anywhere in the entire cosmos. And it's this fine-tuning of the universe for life that has really put the design argument back in center stage. What I like about the fine-tuning argument, Kevin, is it enables us to do an end run around the whole emotionally charged issue of biological evolution and the creation evolution debates and public school debates and courtroom debates and everything, and to go right back to the very beginning of the universe and point out that unless those initial conditions are fine-tuned to an incomprehensible precision, evolution couldn't even take place anywhere in the universe, so that the very evolution of biological life presupposes a designer.
You're going even further back than some of the traditional design arguments that we've all learned and maybe heard in church, and that is, we're just the right distance from the sun, we have just the right amount of oxygen for life. This goes back even further.
That's right. It goes back to the very beginning of the universe, before there ever was an Earth, before there ever was a galaxy, and says that these initial conditions have to be fine-tuned in such a way that the most plausible explanation is intelligent design. So that you don't even need to get into the question of the distance of the Earth from the sun, its atmosphere, its size, the presence of Jupiter. All of those things simply layer on more improbability after you've shown how improbable the fine-tuning is. So the fine-tuning lays the foundation. And then on top of that, you can just layer on more and more improbability as you talk about all of these factors necessary for the existence of life on Earth, and for the origin of life, and then the development of intelligence and complexity. All of that just strengthens the argument for design.
These constants, these fine-tuning aspects that we've discovered, what, the last 50 years?
That's right. That's why this is so recent. This has only really been discovered within the last 40 years or so.
Seems to resist the common objection that, well, if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't be here to observe it. Obviously, it had to be that way. I can see how that would be the case with our distance from the sun, the oxygen, and things like that. But I really get suspicious that there's an intelligence if it goes all the way back to the Big Bang itself, if it goes all the way back to the beginning of the universe, and then these things are there.
Right. It's not enough to say, well, if the universe weren't fine-tuned, then we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. It's certainly true that we could not observe the universe if it weren't fine-tuned, because we'd be dead or we wouldn't even exist. But that in no way means that we shouldn't be surprised that we do observe a universe which is incomprehensibly fine-tuned for our being here. That ought to arouse in us the suspicion that there is some kind of further explanation going on here.
Can you name a couple of things off the top of your head that show this fine-tuning?
Yes, certainly. One of the factors that is the most discussed today, that's really a hot topic, is the so-called cosmological constant. As you mentioned, there are many different constants in nature, and what these are quantities that are constant in the laws of nature when they're given mathematical expression. And one constant is called the cosmological constant. And what this does is that it controls the speed of the expansion of the universe. It determines that the universe will accelerate in its expansion at a certain point. And it's been calculated that this constant has to be fine-tuned to one part out of 10 to the 120th power in order for the universe to be life-permitting. That's one chance out of one followed by 120 zeros.
Wow.
Which
those
is just incomprehensible numbers.
Incomprehensible numbers.
Yeah.
So how does this differ from the traditional William Paley watchmaker arguments? Finding a watch on the beach and you immediately infer that it was designed.
The difference, I think, would be that the examples of design that Paley used were organic features of biological organisms, things like the eye, the ear, the heart, the nose, these sorts of things. And Paley argued that these couldn't have arisen by accident. These must be the products of design. And this is where the Darwinist will counter by saying that these organs are the result of a long period of genetic mutation and natural selection, which has fashioned these organs that look like they're designed, but they're really not. Now, I think you can engage in that debate. That's a good debate to participate in. But I prefer to just do an end run around the whole thing and say there wouldn't even be any planets, there wouldn't even be any galaxies where life might evolve unless the universe was fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life in the very moment of its inception. And so you just completely circumvent that whole debate.
You think we'll continue to discover some of these fine-tuning aspects?
Yes, I do, Kevin. The pattern of discovery with respect to fine-tuning is that any attempt to eliminate the fine-tuning by trying to explain it through some mechanism is kind of like the proverbial bump in the carpet. You depress it at one point, and it pops up at some other place. And that has been the pattern. For example, many scientists thought that you could get rid of the fine-tuning of the expansion of the universe and how homogeneous the universe is by appealing to a so-called inflationary theory of the universe, where the universe, for a brief period of time, inflates very rapidly, a kind of super rapid expansion. And they thought this would explain the so-called flatness problem and the expansion problem. But it was then that they discovered the cosmological constant problem, because it is the cosmological constant that determines the rate of inflation. So the bump in the carpet had been pushed down at one point only to have it pop up somewhere else. And that has been the pattern. This fine-tuning is so various. It's so widely varied, and it's so extensive throughout physics that I think it's extremely unlikely that it's ever going to be eliminated. I think the more we discover, the more this fine-tuning is going to pop up in different places.
Let's turn then to the moral argument for God's existence. Break that down for us, Dr. Craig.
Well, this argument basically has two premises. The first premise is that if God does not exist, then objective values and moral duties do not exist. In the absence of God, basically everything becomes relative. We have no moral duties to fulfill. There are no objective moral values. The second premise is, but there are, in fact, objective moral values and duties. Certain things really are right or wrong, good or evil. And from those two premises, it follows logically and inescapably that God exists. So the atheist who wants to deny God's existence is going to have to deny one of those two premises in order to avoid the conclusion.
A lot of atheists don't want to deny that morals are objective.
Right.
They just don't want them to be somehow located in God.
Yes.
Where do they put them?
Well, yeah, now that's the question, of course. And I think this is a surprise, perhaps, to the layperson. I find that lay people, and especially, say, high school students and even college students, have been taught relativism. And so for them, they think that the controversial premise in this argument is the second one, that objective moral values and duties exist. But in fact, when you talk to professors of philosophy, and when I have debates on this subject, almost nobody disagrees with that second premise. They all recognize that, say, the Holocaust was wrong, that apartheid is wrong, that child abuse is objectively wrong. And so, as you say, Kevin, the atheist usually wants to desperately affirm the existence of objective moral values and duties. And the challenge for him then is to show how, on an atheistic worldview, these things would exist and would be objective and wouldn't just be sort of socio-biological spin-offs of the evolutionary process that produced us. And so it's very, very difficult, I think, for the atheist to have any kind of grounding for objective values and duties.
We've talked about this in some other programs, Bill, talking about the moral argument and so on, and we talked about what it meant for morals to be objective, and that means that they're binding, that they're true and binding on everyone, whether you believe it or not.
That's right. It's they're independent of human opinion. And the argument is that if there isn't any God, then moral values and duties aren't objective in that sense. They're basically dependent upon what people think, what we've come to believe, and so forth. And here, I love to use the work of guys like Richard Dawkins, because Dawkins endorses this first premise. There's a wonderful quotation from him where he says, there is no purpose, there is no meaning, there is no good, there is no evil, there is nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is our sole purpose for living. Well, that is a nihilistic point of view where there is no meaning and there is no objective moral values. Now, what is so interesting about Dawkins is that despite the fact that that's his worldview, he is an unabashed moralist. His books are filled with moral judgments. He condemns those who discriminate against homosexuals. He condemns the religious indoctrination of children. He condemns the Inquisition. He even has his own Ten Commandments in The God Delusion for guiding our lives. So that Dawkins exemplifies the horrible dilemma that the atheist finds himself in. He knows that given his worldview, we are just animals, and animals aren't moral agents. And yet at the same time, he also recognizes that moral values and duties do exist, and he affirms them all the time. And so he's caught in a contradiction.
Well, is something moral because God says that it's moral, or is something moral because God recognizes that it's moral?
This is a very famous argument that's often used against basing moral values in God. Is something good because God says so, or does God say that it's good because it is? And what I want to say is that God says that it's good because God is good. That moral values are rooted in the nature of God. God is essentially loving, compassionate, fair, just, holy, and so forth. And so what God commands us to do flows out of his own moral nature. So his commandments are not arbitrary. They are reflections of his own moral character, which defines what good and evil is. His moral character is the yardstick or plumb line for determining good and evil. So what God says is based upon who God is, and he defines what is good and evil by his very character, and then his commandments to us then constitute our moral duties. That's where right and wrong comes from, is from the commands of a holy and loving God.
Well, how do moral values exist, Dr. Craig? It's not like you can go out and touch them or collect them in a basket. They're just kind of there, and when you think about them, there they are. What's up with that?
Well, I think that moral values are properties of God's nature. I don't think that moral values exist in themselves in some sort of independent realm. This was what Plato believed. He thought that things like justice, fair play, kindness just sort of exist. Well, I, for one, Kevin, just can't make any sense of that. I understand what it means for a person to be kind or to be just, but I don't have a clue what it means to say that independent of any people, kindness just exists or justice just exists. In fact, when you think about it, justice would be a sort of abstract object. It wouldn't itself be just. Kindness isn't itself kind. Mm-hmm. So if there weren't any people, there wouldn't be any justice or kindness. But that contradicts the view that justice and kindness just exist on their own. So the way I see it is justice and kindness are properties of a person, namely God. God is just and kind, and he defines by his moral character what is right and, by contrast, what is wrong or good and evil.
The ontological argument. That's a big name. What do we mean by the ontological?
Yeah, this is a more difficult one to explain to a popular audience.
Well, you only have 5 minutes.
Okay, this is the argument that says if God's existence is even possible, then God must exist. Once you come to see what God is, if you admit that it's even possible that there's a God, then God must actually exist. And I have come to be convinced, after initially thinking this argument wasn't a good argument, I've come to believe that this is a sound argument, that it is.
Really?
Yeah, that it has not only, it's not only valid, but that the premises are true. I think it's a sound argument for God's existence.
Who do we trace this argument back to?
Well, it goes back to a 12th century monk, Anselm of Canterbury, England. And Anselm was trying, he had defended cosmological arguments for God's existence. He wanted to find an argument that would demonstrate that God exists at sort of one fell swoop with all of his superlative attributes. And it was then that Anselm hit upon this concept of God as the greatest conceivable being. And he said, God, by definition, is the greatest conceivable being. If you could conceive of anything greater than God, then that would be God. So God has to be, by definition, the greatest conceivable being. But then Anselm went on to argue that a being which is the greatest conceivable being would have to be one that exists. So if it's even possible that there is a greatest conceivable being, then he must exist.
Wow. Thank you for keeping me up late on that one tonight. Well, what are the objections to that there? What are the
objections? There's only one objection, really, Kevin, to this argument. I mean, when it all boils down to what is at stake here, it is, do we have any reason to think that it's possible that God exists? I think that atheists will concede that if it is informed atheists will say, yes, if it is possible that God exists, then God must exist. And therefore, the atheist has to say it's impossible that God exists. It's not just that God doesn't exist. It's impossible that God exists. There's not even a possibility that there is a God. And so what the atheist will say to the theist or the one who defends the ontological argument is, you can't show me that it's possible that God exists, and therefore I deny the argument. I think God's existence is impossible, and you can't prove to me that it is possible.
What would your move be? Would you supplement the argument then?
Well, I would try to give arguments to suggest that it is possible that God exists, although one has to say that if the atheist takes a strong stand here, I don't think you're going to be able to succeed in dislodging him from that. But what you have done, at least, Kevin, I think this is the merit of the argument, is you've shown him the price that has to be paid for his atheism. It's not enough just to say God doesn't exist. The atheist is going to have to take the more radical position that it's impossible that God exists. And so the benefit of the argument is that even if you can't prove that it's possible that God exists, you've at least been able to show that if God's existence is possible, then God exists.
Most thoughtful atheists don't want to go that far as to say it's impossible that God exists.
They don't want to go that far. I think most people would say, yeah, it's intuitively possible that God exists. Even if he doesn't, it's possible that there could be such a being. And so
when you get there, then that starts getting you down the road to the ontological argument.
Oh, yeah, I think it does, Kevin. That's exactly right. And I think that we can say some things to suggest that it is possible that God exists. For example, when we say that it's impossible for a married bachelor to exist, or a round square, we say that because that's an evidently incoherent concept. The idea of a married bachelor is incoherent because the idea of a bachelor is an unmarried male.
It's a contradiction.
Yeah, so the idea of a married bachelor, we could say, yeah, it's not even possible that a married bachelor exists. But the concept of God isn't like that. There isn't any evident contradiction or inconsistency or incoherence in the concept of God. So the atheist is having to say this is impossible, even though there is no evident incoherence in this concept. And I think the theist will want to say that intuitively this is a coherent idea. It's not like a married bachelor or a round square, so it's intuitively a possible being. And I think that's a strong argument for the possibility of God's existence.
Dr. Krieg, our question of the day, what about all the evil done in the name of God? People cite the Crusades and the Inquisition and crimes committed by religious people.
Well, I guess I would say, Kevin, that that's simply testimony to the fallenness of man. It is testimony to how wicked and perverse we are, that we could take the most beautiful and wonderful things in the world and use them as instruments of violence and torture and cruelty, the way Christianity has sometimes been used in the hands of wicked men. So it does nothing to disconfirm Christianity. On the contrary, if anything, it confirms the Christian doctrine of sin, that we really are depraved and fallen and alienated from God.
I guess every philosophy or every system could be abused.
That's right.
Or perverted.
Bertrand Russell once remarked that you cannot prove a system of thought is true by looking at the lives of its adherents. Now, what he meant was, just because the adherents live good and righteous lives doesn't mean that their system is true. But it also applies to when those adherents fail to live up to their system of beliefs and are wicked and hypocritical and deceitful. In the same way, that doesn't mean that their system of beliefs is false.
For more resources like these from Dr. William Lane Craig, go to ReasonableFaith.org. That's ReasonableFaith.org.